Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, September 28th, 2020, and I'm the host of the show, Cara Santa Maria. We have a great one for you this week, but before we dive in, I want to thank those of you who continue to make Talk Nerdy possible week after week. Remember, Talk Nerdy is 100% free to download, and that's because of the support from listeners just like you. So if you want to pledge your support, visit patreon.com/talknerdy like these amazing people did, including Mary Neva, Charles Payet, Christopher Pitts, David J.E. Smith, Dudas Infinitas, June Sapara, Pasquale Gelati, and who else we got here? Ulrika Hagman, Brian Holden, Michael Gaucher, and yeah, lots more guys, lots more, but those are the top tier folks. And I always want to give them a nice call out at the beginning of the show. Okay. I'm super excited about this week's episode because we have a returning guest, one of my favorite guests. Her name is Caitlin Doty. She's a mortician and an activist. In 2011, she founded the Order of the Good Death, which is a death acceptance collective. She has an amazing YouTube series called Ask a Mortician. She owns her own kind of alternative funeral home, Clarity Funerals, here in LA. And she has written a few amazing books about death. Her most recent one is called Will My Cat Eat My Eyeballs? And it's now in paperback. The new subtitle is Will My Cat Eat My Eyeballs and Other Questions About Dead Bodies? This is such an important topic. I'm so glad I got to take some time with Caitlin this week. So without any further ado, here she is, Caitlin Doty. Well, Caitlin, thank you so much for joining me yet again on Talk Nerdy.
Thank you for having me back. I heard I'm one of the rare guests that gets to make a second appearance.
I'm so excited. Well, you're one of the rare guests that wrote a really brilliant second book. And also, I just think that what you do is so badass and your message is so important. So I've been kind of like champing at the bit to get you back on since your book came out. When did Will My Cat Eat My Eyeballs? Big Questions from Tiny Mortals About Death, first get published?
It actually was published exactly a year ago because the paperback just came out, which is so wild because a year ago in September, I did a full book tour, you know, traveling right all around the country. And it feels so long ago. It feels so profoundly long ago that this book came out and it was a year, which I think is very relatable to most people.
COVID has completely destroyed time because somehow it simultaneously accelerated. Like we live years later in the future, right? Like it feels like you said, like September was many years ago. But then there are times where I'm doing nothing. And then I'm like, how is it September?
I've seen small little articles or tweets about this, but I can't wait until someone writes a serious deep dive piece on the science of time during the pandemic and
right
why it feels extended or contracted. And I mean, my suspicion, just because it's my bias, is that I think that our sense of death and our desire for achievement has been cut off in a weird way. So if you're someone who's normally fairly ambitious and gets a lot of your self-esteem from our gig economy hellscape, you know, capitalist hellscape, mm-hmm. if you're someone who can just keep working and then all of a sudden you keep working, but you're just spinning your wheels and there's no real purpose to it and people are dying. And I think it just completely skews our sense of lived
time. I think
you're
right. I think it's kind of thrown a lot of people, and again, this is my bias, which is coalescing well with yours, but it's thrown a lot of people into this very existential place mm-hmm. where they are thinking about things that they didn't think about before, where they are almost being forced to be introspective and forced to be meditative, or if they're still not willing to go to that kind of like what, you know, some philosophers call the ontological mode of being, mm-hmm. then they're just avoiding it at all costs with all sorts of weird filler. And I think combine that with a lack of external cues, you know, usually our days pass because we have patterns and systems. And that's often what psychologists help people who are struggling with feeling really uncontained to develop in their lives, right? It's like if you have, you know, daily routines, then that's going to help you start to feel like you have more control. And right now, I think everybody's routine is out the window.
Yeah, everyone's routine is certainly out the window. And it feels to me, at least people in my orbit or colleagues, it feels like you either have to really face some difficult things that are being brought to the surface, in which case, yeah, you're probably moving yourself forward, but you're also having, you know, maybe facing depression or facing anxiety because these things are coming up and you are willing to face them and engage them, or you're denying them and losing your mind a little bit and acting out and doing some things that represent your worst self that you might never normally feel comfortable doing, but there's a high cost to repressing dark thoughts.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I'm so glad that we have the opportunity. I wish it could be in person, but of course, COVID. But I'm so glad that we have the opportunity to get back together and to talk about a lot of these concepts. You know, I want to talk about obviously what you dive into in the book, but I also want to talk about where things are with your funeral practice. And before we even get into that, I thought you should know for kind of context and reference, the last time we talked, I remember you were at my old house with me. Mm-hmm. I think I was thinking about going back to school.
Or yeah, maybe I remember you telling me that.
Yeah, like it was like an idea in my head, or maybe I was like doing research. I am now a fourth-year PhD student. And,
wow.
Right? And I specialize in existential psychotherapy and my research area. And I just started a new clinical area. My research is in death and dying, and my clinical area right now is in psycho-oncology in a cancer clinic.
I love it. As the kids say, I love that for you. I love that for you. That's fantastic.
So I'm always
welcome
wanted,
to the team,
right? Yeah,
team death.
I'm always really excited to talk about death professionals and death practitioners in kind of all these different allied fields, because it's one thing I'm really lacking in my psych training, and I shouldn't say I'm lacking it, but it's something I've had to be self-directed on because there aren't any psychologists at my university that specialize in life-limiting illness and terminal illness and kind of that last developmental stage, which is actively dying.
Yeah, and it's like, where does existentialism come from? It comes,
right?
And again, because of my bias, I see it as you have existential angst because life ends. Mm-hmm. And that's the troubling fact that we learn at a certain point in our lives. And I guess this is kind of connected to writing a book for kids about death, because you can either usher children into a safe death place where you tell them that honest conversations around death and dying are normal and they're fine and they are safe to ask these questions, or you can paste some of our Western world denial bullshit on the children. And it becomes much easier to be a more well-integrated adult if you have those kind of hard conversations earlier in your life. And I don't know how you've found this in your practice, but I think a lot of the meaninglessness that people feel maybe comes from not being able to admit where their self-esteem comes from and where they're getting their self-esteem. And that's so connected to death.
Right. Yeah. You know, I've mentioned it before on the show, but the kind of architecture or the scaffolding that I tend to draw from, and there are all sorts of different existential psychologists. A lot of people pull from Viktor Frankl. I'm really oriented towards Irvin Yalom's work. And he talks about the four givens of existence. One is the fear of death. And that's really a big focus for him. One is meaninglessness and what people's journey towards meaning is. One is freedom versus responsibility, and the other one is loneliness. And ultimately, I do think that there's a death through line that even in some ways is kind of inextricably related to the other three, what he calls givens of existence.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love him. He's been really influential for me. And I was just sent his new book early
cool.
to look at, and I was like, oh my God, I've made it.
That's so great. And you know, you wrote this amazing book for kids, or kind of based on kids' questions. And I'm remembering in Yalom's existential therapy kind of like the book that everybody studies, a whole chapter on how kids relate to death. And he's very frank, like you are, that kids know a hell of a lot more than you think. They think more critically about this and deeply about this than a lot of adults are willing to give them credit for. And there are things about death that they can take. And if we shield them in too dramatic a fashion, it can actually be really detrimental for their development.
Absolutely, because you're, and I was able, lucky enough, to talk to a lot of psychiatrists and mm-hmm. and psychologists during this process, because I didn't want to mess it up. I didn't want to, you know, I didn't want to harm anyone's child with this. Right. And I do try and say in the intro of the book, I'm like, listen, I'm just your weird aunt. Like, I'm not your psychologist. I'm your total weirdo aunt who won't stop talking about the corpse. But you're my cool nephew who won't stop asking me about the corpse. And I think I've sort of become, in doing this book, I've become the person that my friends who are now in their mid to late 30s and having children, and the children start to ask questions, and then they come to me and they're like, is this okay? Is this normal? And the answer is, for the most part, unless they are deeply obsessive or deeply, you know, repeating negative behaviors around death issues, yeah, it's 100% normal. And what you're setting up at a very early age, and we're talking like 3 years old, mm-hmm. In some cases, 4 years old, 5 years old, what you're setting up by being calm and collected and open in those conversations when they ask about, you know, what does it mean that this frog is flattened on the road? Or what does it mean that grandma's disappeared? When you're willing to have those conversations with them, you are setting up their whole lives, not just around death, but around any difficult conversation they want to have about their sexuality, about politics. They know that you are a calm central force that can handle any tough questions that they have. And you're kind of imprinting on them early that you are going to be the source of that kind of dialogue. And I think that's so more important than getting the answer right, more important than, like, you know, nailing the answer about the flattened frog is just setting up that expectation for them.
Right. You're building not only a sense of like really deep, authentic trust with your child, or I guess reinforcing it, but you're also kind of showing them that you can hold the space for them, so that if they're in pain, especially if they're asking questions, not just out of a developmental fundamental curiosity, but let's say somebody close to them dies and they're asking these questions, that you can contain that and that you can be that source of love and containment for them, which unfortunately, I think a lot of kids have attachment or develop attachment issues at this age when they do lose people, because it's like, well, mom can't even handle it, or dad can't even handle my pain, so I don't want to bring that to them.
Yeah. And you can have, especially if, you know, if grandma dies, let's say, and mm-hmm. it was your mother and your child is grieving, it's okay to grieve in front of them, but explain why you're doing it. You know, explain why you're sad. Explain why it's okay. Don't like close your door and, you know, take your quaaludes like some sort of 50s housewife. Like, be able to have that, you know, trust them to be around the hard things. Trust them to go to the funeral if that's what they want. Don't force them to walk up and kiss the corpse if they don't want to do that. But let them be there and let them participate in some way. You know, do they want to write a note and put it in the casket? Do they want to hold grandma's hand? You know, don't let them take the lead on what they'd like to do. And you, again, will give them a real sense of self-reliance and confidence in you to let them take the lead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because really, when it comes down to it, you know, I think in our society, in sort of a modern Western, but definitely especially American society, the fear and denial around death and the medicalization around death is so extreme that it's often become something that people don't even discuss, like something that's taboo, which to me is bananas considering how fundamental to the lived experience it is, and how in so many cultures it's a normal thing. People are around conversations, they're around dead bodies, they, you know, engage in funerary practices that are much more hands-on, and we're just very detached, right? And that's not just affecting us as adults, but it's also affecting children.
Yeah, and I love, that's why my biggest advice or my biggest remedy for the world is just to hang around corpses more, mm-hmm. you know, preferably corpses you knew in some way, not just random ones that you come across, but... The idea is that, like, the number one thing that I think could renormalize death for us is just seeing the result of it in a non-threatening manner in the right. home or in the parlor, and letting the kids be around it and letting everyone be around them, and knowing that it's not dangerous or it's not going to get out of control. It's just a dead body, folks. And that sort of, it's interesting, in academic circles, there's a lot of people who like to debate whether or not we really have a denial of death in America, or it's a taboo, and what those exact terms mean academically. Right. And some people say that it's not denial because we're, you know, we have horror movies and we have horror on the news and we're constantly watching TV shows and cop shows that deal with death, and we watch true crime and we're very engaged with death. But I would argue that it's not just like pure death that we're in denial of, it's normalized death that we're in denial of. You're probably, as many true crime podcasts as you listen to, you're probably not going to be murdered in a terrible way by your intimate partner and thrown off a cliff and found 2 months later. That is not likely to happen to you. But you are likely to get cancer and end up in a hospice or end up in a nursing home and end up being cremated or being buried. Those are the things that are obviously going to happen to you. And yet those are the things we don't talk about or hear about. So you have one person like me, and there are other advocates like me, but, you know, you have one podcast like mine or one web series like mine, and then you have 2,000 about true crime. So right. I think our fear leads us to really fetishize the incredibly dark, horrific ways to die and have zero conversations about the way that you will actually probably die.
I think you're right. And even the fetishized, foci of those different approaches is, I don't know, it's like Hollywoodified to some extent. So even that doesn't really reflect the rare reality, because every so often you'll come across a true crime documentary where there are real crime scene photos that are shown and where individuals are really diving deep into what happened to the body. Maybe it'll be like a more forensic focus, and you have people who are pretty clear in their language. But a lot of times, I think if you were to sit somebody down who only watches and listens to true crime and then ask them basic questions about death biology, right. they would be so off their answers.
Yeah. No, my Marian Hamill, who's a forensic pathologist and a friend of mine, she says the only way to know the exact moment that someone died from a crime scene is if they were shot in the watch.
Right.
Because there's, you know, the science is still so inaccurate, and it's a work in progress. But the way that if you want to watch a show like CSI or a true crime show, you would think that anything is possible. Mm-hmm. And there's a really interesting study that I think is connected to the impulse is the same as what we see in true crime, which is like young, white, and beautiful getting the right. attention. They did a study of crowdfunding sites for funerals, and they found that if you are young and attractive, you're going to raise more money.
Oh, God.
Then, so we have this very broken funeral system where the federal government doesn't even feel like it's necessary to offer financial support to families for funerals. And we have a funeral poverty problem. And you have to have this kind of popularity contest to get any support, financial support from your community. So the people who are actually dying at 87 from Alzheimer's or a heart attack, they are not the charismatic dead that the public is looking for.
Ugh, right. And then you add to that, you know, a big focus of the last interview that we did on the show, which is the sort of predatory nature of the modern funeral industry and overselling and upselling and putting people in a position where they feel guilt and shame if they're not willing to buy the best version of the casket or the best version of the headstone. So then you have this excessive poverty, you know, funerary poverty, where now people are feeling guilt and shame because they can't afford the best funeral.
Yeah. And it's difficult because the reality is that wealthy people spend significantly less on funerals than low-income people. And I don't mean like versus their income. I mean, period, whole numbers, what? Full stop. Yes, because it's a conspicuous consumption-related purchase. It's something that I think especially people of color have been made to feel systemically over many years that it is a sign of how you make it in America is having that kind of huge community funeral that costs maybe $12,000. And I think that is true in many, you know, I guess I would say like low income communities across the country is feeling like that's how you show, you know, you weren't able to give this person never got the respect they deserved in life. And so we're going to do everything we can to show them respect in death. And respect means money, because of how we've set up this death system. And, you know, you end up putting a second mortgage on your house or desperately trying to crowdfund or taking out payday loans to pay for a funeral when that absolutely should, or choosing between paying your rent or paying for the funeral. And that absolutely should not be the way that it is, especially in a country like the United States.
Right. Like the core mentality or the core kind of cultural component seems like it probably follows in a lot of cultures, you know, Western cultures, Eastern cultures, developing nations. But it's the capitalist component and the way that the funeral system has become or basically started as such a predatory entity that really does seem to be the big problem, because you don't have to have a lot of money even to have a big community mourning or a big community celebration.
No, not at all. Yeah, no, it's not like, you know, it's the number of people that's the problem. It's the services offered. And there was this period in the late 19th century, early 20th century, where it really was this kind of dark dance between an emerging industry where there was no industry before, an emerging funeral industry, and a desire for those men to seem professional and to get credit for being professional and things that only they could do, like embalm the body and store the body. And then you also had this upcoming young group of capitalists and industrialists who wanted people out of their home. They wanted the funeral out of the home, and they wanted to show their burgeoning wealth through this funeral service. And so these two things came together. It's almost similar to like a Silicon Valley, where, you know, you have these young people with so much money, and then you have these, you know, CEOs with these dark visions, and they kind of come together to create this tech, you know, dystopia. And it's kind of very similar, I think, to what happened at the beginning of the funeral industry, where you have the force of the consumer and the new industry come together and sets us off on a path that has proven thus far to be impossible to come back from.
Right. And in so many ways, you know, I'd love to get your insight on how that was maybe facilitated, or that movement that is really, I don't know, I keep using the word predatory, but I mean, I don't know if that's always the best word, but that movement that really does take advantage of people in a critical period when they're very distraught, when they're overwhelmed, how much of that is made possible because of our sort of denialistic culture, because of our inability to have made the right decisions and have been thinking about these things throughout the lifespan so that in those last critical moments, we're not paralyzed with fear and overwhelmed.
Right. I mean, there are a lot of factors here, and there are a lot of micro villains in the story. Some of it absolutely comes from people's inability to talk about it. And I don't put full blame on people who, at the toughest time of their lives, haven't researched cremation prices.
Right.
You know, yeah. That's not the time that you necessarily want to do it. Would it be great if that education was out there? And do I constantly push that education? Absolutely. But you can see why that doesn't work all the time.
Yeah.
Because people are just not, they're not in the mood to do it right then. And then at the same time, you have this industry that's developed and the sort of more modern aspect of just huge corporations, massive, massive corporations that run funeral homes and buy up a bunch of funeral homes and they buy up cemeteries and just make certain people incredibly wealthy off death. And these funeral homes, these certain funeral home corporations and companies, they've done studies that found that they charge, you can save literally thousands of dollars by just making a couple of phone calls and going across the street to a different funeral home or a smaller funeral home. And people don't know that. And but I think that at this point, my current subject of my ire, I think more than anything, is the federal government. It's our government. And it's really only funeral service that low-income people are forced to go to a private business for service and have no other choice.
Right.
You're
There's no public option.
Unless you want to turn your body over to be cremated by the state and never seen again, or by the county, or buried by the county, or buried on Hart Island in, you know, off New York, and you never get to see them or visit them ever again. I mean, you can maybe visit them, but it's incredibly difficult, and you don't know where they're buried.
That's like a classic pauper's grave kind of situation.
Yeah, classic pauper's grave situation. Unless you're going for the pauper's grave option, you have to transact with a private business and there is no help for you. There is no financial help or aid or guidance. And yeah, that's a massive problem. And I do hope that this, maybe fingers crossed, is one of the things among many other things, inequalities that the pandemic kind of reveals and brings to the forefront for people.
You would think, or at least you would hope, that, you know, low-income individuals who are lucky enough to utilize hospice services, that the kind of mental health component that is woefully underfunded and is woefully not present. I mean, that's something that I'm trying to develop skills for so that I can enter into that sector. But you would think that part of the kind of hospice approach would also be the post-death planning and the facilitating of the family through these really difficult kind of processes.
I you would think, and I know that a couple of years ago there was a lot of concern in the funeral industry that hospice was going to enter the funeral industry, like hospices were going to try to also be licensed as funeral homes, which I don't think, at least not in California, hasn't really proven to be the case. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I feel for hospice in a way, because they don't have any choice. Again, they don't have any choice for their families but to refer them to private businesses. There's
right.
no other option. Like, you can, I do encourage, if you are in hospice or if you're a hospice nurse or a social worker or related to it, tell families about lower cost funerals, tell them about home funerals and the potential to just take care of, you know, if somebody dies at home on hospice, you can just keep the body there.
Right.
And keep them there for 2 days, 3 days. That's completely available to you.
Yeah. Engage in some kind of traditional practices that are actually really fulfilling to the family and that we know measurably, we know improve mental health outcomes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And know that that's available and you're empowered to do it. And especially if you have a hospice person, like if a hospice person or a hospice representative and a family have been taking care of this person for a couple of weeks now, and for the family, maybe months or years, it's not like they suddenly change when they die. If anything, it's a lot easier to take care of them after they die because they're not in pain anymore and they're not actively dying. So the pressure's off. So it's actually quite, for many people, a very healing experience because they can see firsthand that the person is no longer in pain and no longer struggling.
And it's such a gradual process. too, mm-hmm. like dying in hospice. You know, most, you mentioned this earlier, most people don't die a violent death. Like it does happen. You know, people get into car crashes, people are murdered, people have sudden cardiac events and drop dead on, you know, on site. But the vast majority of people, because of our amazing, you know, improvements in healthcare, die slowly. That's just how it is with chronic illnesses. And when you die slowly, there's a course that a lot of people follow, and they get more and more tired, and they sleep more and more, and then eventually they're unconscious, and then, you know, they slip away. And so those gradual stages are already priming the family and the friends, the caretakers, to see those changes.
Yes, and if something else that's important is that in that time, a good hospice nurse or social worker has been preparing the family for all of this and has been talking them through exactly what they're going to see and what's likely to happen and building that trust with the family. I've had families who absolutely just adore their hospice nurse. But it's when they die, it's like it just stops.
Mm-hmm. And they're like, my job's done. I got to go work with somebody else.
Yeah. And
now.
I don't mean that it's in like a rude way, but just because those two industries are so separated because, you know, it's hospice and funeral homes are two totally different things. And there's no continuum of care there. There's no rainbow bridge that carries us from one to another.
Yeah, the continuum of care from patient to dead body. I think a lot of like, especially our healthcare industry, which is so freaking broken, it seems like it'd be a tall order to expect that Medicare is going to continue to help the dead body. You know what I mean?
Right. But that's a good question because it becomes like it's not really a medical expense. Funerals aren't really a medical expense. They're more of a social service expense. Right. They're more of a, you know, this person who is teetering on the edge of the poverty line is going to fall into poverty and it's going to affect possibly the rest of their lives and their children's lives if they have to unexpectedly pay $12,000 for a funeral.
And how weird that we like... It's like, it's already written, right? Like, we owe this check because we're all going to freaking die. So there's this almost pressure that's over our heads that one day it's going to get expensive and hopefully I have, you know, good life insurance or I have good retirement money or whatever, but everybody is living longer. Most people are burning through their retirement. We're just not prepared. We're not prepared emotionally. We're not prepared psychologically. We're not prepared just from a pure knowledge perspective. And then financially, we're really not prepared.
No, and if the societal expectation or the expectation of the people around you is that it's somehow going to be disrespectful if you're not paying $12,000, you know, the actual average funeral cost is between $7,000 to $10,000, but that brings in a lot of places where things are a lot cheaper. In Los Angeles, the average cost is much higher, as you might expect.
But so that's like the average meaning that we're also
the average meaning
the rural,
of the United States, including rural areas, including a place where you can buy a burial plot for $3,000. You know, like good luck getting anything in Los Angeles for, you know, you can buy a grave for just your hand for $3,000. But it really does. What is the stat that two thirds of people couldn't come up with $400? In an emergency?
Oh, right. Just offhand, like today, liquid cash. Yeah. I'm not surprised.
They can't do it. And it's just not possible. There was an interesting story of someone running for local government in Washington who said, you know, I believe he was kind of a lefty. And what he was saying was, you know, funeral costs are too high. We need to offer stipends to families. And we're going to offer stipends of $600 or $6,000. And to people's credit, I think people probably who, you know, were tagging me or who know this were like, you know, if the stipend is $6,000, the funeral directors will find a way to make it cost $6,000.
Yeah, they'll just keep, it'll be bloated. Like,
yeah,
that's the idea.
It doesn't have to cost anywhere near $6,000. What we need to be doing is promoting, here is what you can get for $2,000. And here's how you can still make it respectful, beautiful, meaningful, etc., so forth.
And so other funeral, because you have a funeral home, you have a funeral practice, and your approach obviously is very alternative. So other funeral directors who have a much more traditional approach must think you are evil. Like, they must feel very threatened by your education and your approach.
They do. Yeah, they don't. They're not a huge fan of me. That's not true universally. There's a lot of funeral directors who absolutely agree with the things I preach, even if they think I'm a little radical. They agree that the families need more options. They cannot stand the idea that they're overcharging families or causing hardship to families. Because a lot of people, and keep in mind too, that a lot of just funeral directors aren't the ones making the money. It's right. Funeral home owners, not necessarily me, but if you're with the way that we have prices, but funeral home owners and like corporate positions and higher ups in the funeral industry are the ones making the money. You're just, your local funeral director is making $50,000-$60,000 a year. So They are not the ones who are like cackling on mom's grave and rubbing money on themselves like Indecent Proposal. They are just trying to do a good thing. But unfortunately, they exist in a system that is not designed with the family in mind.
Well, and they have to stay competitive to keep their doors open, which must be really frustrating if you're a small mom and pop funeral home. Maybe you're lucky enough to live in a town where there isn't a big corporate funeral industry that has like moved its way into your town, because I can imagine that these corporate entities have figured out how to make things cheaper on the bottom line so that they can then inflate them to get bigger profits.
Yep. Economies of scale, big time, big centralized embalming facilities where all the bodies go to be prepared in one central location and then get sent back out to all the satellite locations.
Which, as we discussed in the last time that we chatted, is like not even necessary. Like, embalming's not even necessary.
No, it's definitely not. And if you choose it for your family, that's great. But it's wildly overdone in the United States. And the reason that it's overdone is because funeral homes and funeral home owners have really invested everything in this idea of a traditional or conventional funeral, which means you have the $100,000 embalming room, you have the many $1,000s caskets room display, you have this fancy hearse, you have this big chapel, you have the prayer cards, you have the relationships with the cemeteries, you have all these things set up for a very specific type of funeral that more and more people, especially as we get into baby boomers and Gen X potentially dying, that's not what they want for the most part. And less people are going to want that. But what the funeral industry attempts to do is attempts to set up laws, making it hard for a family to choose or a funeral home to open that doesn't offer all of those things.
Which is so frustrating. Like, and what it really does is it develops a lacking of personal autonomy and of choice and really of confidence. I think what you end up seeing a lot of times is people saying, well, I didn't know you could do that. Or isn't that illegal? Like, that's a common refrain for people who want to be more involved. Like, you can't just bury somebody in the ground, right? There's regulations around that. And a lot of people don't realize that they themselves can like have the body in their home, or can you transport a body? Like, I don't even know.
Yeah, constantly people are saying, I didn't know that. And sometimes we actually lose a lot of families or people who were potentially going to come to us because, you know, they say, okay, we're going to have a service and we want the body there. And of course, we'll need embalming. And we'll say, you know, you actually don't need embalming. You know, it's something we could potentially offer to you, but here's all the reasons that you really don't need it. And they are potentially made very uncomfortable by that because they just can't believe that it's possible to not do that, because they had to do it with their mom and they had to do it with their dad. So surely they have to do it now. And it's not like it's deeply meaningful to them. It's not, you know, what we get from them isn't the feedback that we want embalming because it's sacred, or we want it because it's aesthetically beautiful, or we want it for these very personal reasons. It's just they want it because that's what they had before and were told they had to do.
And I can only imagine that, you know, this vulnerability that people feel, which can so easily be taken advantage of. You know, it comes down to wanting to do right by your loved ones. It comes down to wanting to celebrate them in death and do all of the things that you think that they deserve. And so readily, I can imagine that people's faiths, people's religions, people's familial traditional practices can almost be twisted and bastardized in a way that it adds to the sort of algorithm of predatory behavior.
It can. And I think another important thing here is that when you make it by law in your state so much harder, they're called ready to embalm laws, which I'm always happy to rail against, meaning you got to be ready to embalm if you're a funeral home at any time, ready to embalm, even if you're a Jewish funeral home or a Muslim funeral home or a green funeral home.
Even if it's completely against your religion.
Exactly. Oh, wow. You still have to have you still have to go to school to become a funeral director and get an embalming license, even if you want to open a Muslim funeral home. Ugh. And so having those barriers to entry, you should be able to go, like, if, you know, if you're, I don't want to say, okay, let me see. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I just like zoned out.
No, it's also like 10 o'clock at night. Don't worry about it. I'm like, hello.
I've just kind of been talking all day. This is my passion. So I have a lot to say about this. Truly, I just kind of like looked at my fan and just kind of went into a huge state.
Like,
and I was ranting about, okay, I can get back on track here. Focus.
Love it.
I think this is important to talk about because if you come from a very specific religious group or ethnic group, and it's important that you have certain rituals, people within your community should be able to open a very small funeral home to help you and have your own practices. But the way that the barrier to entries are set up now, that's almost impossible unless you want to basically go to school and be trained in the ways of like white capitalist funeral traditions. You cannot then go back and open your small funeral home without doing that.
Ugh. And then I bet you the lobby argues it, like completely twists the logic and says it's about
health.
Choice. Right. Like we want to have all the options available. Mm-hmm. Those places don't have all the options. So they're actually not serving the public the way that we do.
Well, that's the thing is that like one of the things that I really like about my funeral home is that we don't have all the options available. You know, the point is that we're kind of like the in and out of funerals. Like we have a few things that we do really well. We're not a diner that you need every single option. Because here's the thing, even if you go to a funeral home that has all of these options and has a price list that's 20 pages long, they're probably going to try and get you to do the exact same normie thing, white American normie thing that they want you to do. You want you to buy this casket. They want you to have this viewing. They want you to have this wake. They want you to have this funeral service followed by a witnessed burial. They're going to want you to buy all the same things, even though they ostensibly offer all of these various things.
Right. The platinum package with 7 add-ons. So explain to those who are listening maybe a little bit about what your alternative funeral practice, like what's kind of your mission statement and how do you view the approach to serving the community at Clarity Funerals?
Sure. So it's in the name. We picked the name Clarity because we wanted to emphasize transparency. First and foremost. So we want, if you go to our website or if you call us because someone has died, we want you to immediately feel that we're not dodging around price questions, we're not dodging around service questions, that we're just very clear and concise about what we can offer you and what's possible and what's available to you. Something else that we specialize in is family involvement. We love for family members to come in and dress their dead loved one if they feel, if that feels meaningful. You know, just be there, help put on mom's makeup. If her lipstick doesn't look right, you should jump right on in there and help, because that's, you're right. This is your mom. This is not our dead body. This is your dead body. Mm-hmm. Breaking down some of those fears that people might have being around a dead body, and then being there either for a green burial, not having the body embalmed, and then burying them in a simple grave. We work most often with the cemetery in Joshua Tree, which is lovely. Could you be buried out in the desert under the wild, you know, in the wild sky. And then being able to have a witness cremation. So if you choose cremation, being there to watch the person be loaded in, to be with them to their very final moments, and even come and sort of symbolically push the button to start the process. And we find that when people feel, are able to overcome any 20th century American cultural fears around death to do those things, their grieving process is better, their relationship to death is better, and their feelings about what a funeral home is can be better as well.
Right, right. There's less, I mean, we fear what we don't know, and we feel almost like preemptively overwhelmed because the narrative is that it's just a hard, horrible process. And so everybody kind of goes into it already making their minds up that it's just going to be, you know, negative. And I think we think the same thing, not just about the post-death practices, but we think the same thing about dying. And, you know, earlier we discussed the idea that most people aren't, quote, lucky enough to die suddenly, but I actually look at it differently. I think most people are lucky enough to die slowly. And, you know, with modern approaches to palliative care, there are many opportunities in a longer death to experience that kind of meaning. And just like with your work, which is, you know, comes after the passing, there are many experiences for the family to develop and foster a sense of meaning in the post-death practices.
Yeah, and I would argue though that the purpose of a longer dying period is to have those conversations.
Yep.
Yeah. And the opportunity that we're given, if you squander the opportunity and are in just as much denial the whole time they're in hospice and come to the funeral home and say, we never even had a conversation. We don't know what mom wants. Like, what were you doing? And I know it's hard. I'm not trying to blame you. I know it's incredibly hard, but that is the joy and the opportunity in that.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's almost like counterintuitive to a lot of people who haven't thought too deeply about it yet, but being in it and being open and discussing it actually reduces the terror, and it improves the loving connections.
Well, I had just the other day, I did what's called an urn release in the industry, which is basically the family comes to pick up dad in an urn. And it was the son, and it was his mother, and his mother just spoke Spanish, and he was translating for her. And he asked a question, and he was like, you could tell he was very hesitant to ask the question. He felt it was almost inappropriate, and it was just a question about the cremation process. And I immediately was like, oh no, let me tell, you know, and then I was telling him and he was asking more questions, and then his mom was asking questions and we were translating. And, you know, those are the conversations that I live for. That's why I love this so much. And as the owner, I get to do a lot less of it than I used to be able to, because I'm now just, you know, the suit, not wearing a suit, but the suit behind the scenes. But those are the questions that made me really love this work and love doing it so much, because you can see, just even if you talk to them for 15 or 20 minutes about the cremation process and exactly what happened and what the ashes are made out of and you know, what they could do with the ashes. If you have those really honest conversations with them, they're so grateful, because they may not know it, but they've been holding this tension or holding these fears. And being able to talk to someone who's just happy to talk to them about it. And does, I mean, that kind of goes back to the kids thing too, right?
It, like, absolutely.
If you're a parent who's just happy to sit down and have the conversation, and why are those bugs eating that dead squirrel? I don't know. Let's see if we can Google it together. Let's try and figure out this answer. You know, having that kind of you know, again, as you said, holding the space for people is, as a, any sort of professional or parent in that example, is the best thing that you can offer someone.
Well, and I think that this is what you have really developed so skillfully throughout your career. And we consumers, let me think of another word. We as individuals who can watch your, you know, YouTube series or listen to your podcast or read your books or even learn from you in other more direct ways, like through working with you at your funeral home, I think we're lucky enough to experience something that many authors actually struggle with. And I think that this is a unique skill that you have. And I see it mirrored beautifully in one of my other favorite living authors, Mary Roach, which is talking about concepts in a way that are fundamentally authentic and beautiful and human and respectful, but also being able to be very clear in the language and not be so worried about being careful that you're covering up the truth. And sorry, that's a long-winded way.
No, I'll take that. That's lovely. Could you blurb my next book with that?
Yeah, read the whole back of the book.
Yeah.
Lots of ellipses. But yeah, it speaks specifically, I think, to your newest book, because what children do so well is they cut through the bullshit and they ask the questions that all of us are wondering, but we've learned throughout our you know, lifespan living, especially here in America, that it's not okay to ask those questions. But kids don't know what's polite to do in society. So they just, you know, they ask. And I love that.
Yeah. Again, I'm hoping to be all of America's weird aunt, not just the children.
Yes.
Just like, let me, you know, weird Auntie Caitlin, who, you know, you never know what she's going to say, but, you know, she has some good points.
And the thing is, we can all be more like children because it's culturally, the taboos are so great that most of us ultimately, unless we study this, unless this is part of our, you know, academic or clinical or practical day-to-day, we don't know the answers to any of these questions.
Yeah. No, and it's really, again, it's strange that I'm seen as sort of a niche practitioner in some ways, because I'm like, you know, this is the universal. It's literally they're like, oh, death and taxes. Not everybody pays taxes. Everybody dies. Yeah. Not everybody has sex. Everybody dies. Like, I win. True. I am the most universal career of them all. Damn you.
That's so funny. You're right. But death and dying is niche, even in industries that you think of as being fundamentally linked to these things, like psychology.
Or like the medical field. Like,
right,
what do you think,
yeah,
like medicine is designed to prevent? Like, your death, guys. Like, we're trying not to, you're trying to have you not die, but you do die. Like,
and
that's
something,
that's how it's going to go for everyone.
It's something I've seen a lot as I read more about palliative care, about hospice care, about psycho-oncology, is that historically, and still to a major extent today, many practitioners actually feel like they failed when somebody moves into a hospice phase. And so it's sort of like, well, I'm no longer healing. Even psychologists, I see the mentality in my colleagues where they're like, you want to work with dying people? That's so weird, because our whole job as psychologists is to help people get better. And like, there's no better. And I'm like, yes, there is. Like, while you're dying, you're still alive. And there's so much growth and development. And I think we could say the same thing for even after you're dead, there's so much growth and development and love and meaning that exists.
Yeah, that your death can cause for other people. You know, and that's one of the important things that we were talking about being present for the dying process, if that's available to you, and being present with the dead body after the dying process, because that's all like good shit for you. That's all prime opportunity, even if you're not, like, it's prime opportunity for the dying person, but also for everybody who's close to the dying person and the now dead person. It's this fantastic opportunity to not only dig into what that person meant to you in your life, but also what dying means to you. Hey, you're going to die. What does that mean? Your grandma died 2 years ago and you just kind of ignored it and pushed it down. Well, you're going to have those feelings now. Surprise. Like, can you work through them? Are you capable of integrating mortality into your life in a healthier way? And this is your opportunity to do that.
Yeah, we talked about that a bit previously, that the first time you're sort of remotely close to a death, you really reflect deeply. It triggers a deep reflection, if you're willing to go there, of your own mortality. So you're not just mourning grandma, you're mourning your own life. And the more often you have that kind of exposure, the more tempered, and I think, like you said, integrated that what we would call in psychology mortality salience becomes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And mortality salience is where understanding of yourself comes, mm-hmm. I think. So if you're not aware that you are mortal, you are not a very self-aware person.
Absolutely. Yeah. You're really going to have a hard time working on your relationships
you.
And yeah, working on all the things people go to therapy mm-hmm. for. You're going to be like that client who's just really not even, you know.
Yeah. I've spent years working on things in therapy, which has been super helpful for me. And I'm completely aware of my own death. Like I can't even imagine how hard it is to get good work with people when they don't want to admit that.
Well, and that's why that's really in many ways my approach, right? Because I truly believe that your understanding of your own mortality, your place in the universe, how do you develop meaning? You know, I take a more secular approach, which is like, whereas Viktor Frankl was more religious, obviously, he survived Auschwitz. And so he took this approach that there's an inherent meaning that it's ours to uncover. And I take a more secular approach that as like artists, we must create meaning because, you know, the world is absurd and there is no meaning inherently. But regardless of how you approach it, finding that meaning, struggling with your sense of responsibility to yourself and to the world and your sense of freedom, you know, questioning your own mortality. I personally believe that underlies everything, every form of either traditional clinical diagnosable psychopathology, but also just everyday life struggles that we have.
Yep, you're preaching to the choir here.
Love it.
I hear you.
Maybe some people listening feel the same way, maybe not.
Yeah, if you've gotten to this point in the podcast, say hallelujah.
So listen, you know, there are two things that I want to dive into in the short time that we have left, because I think we have a unique opportunity to do so. The first one is, you know, how have you felt that your nonprofit work, your educational work, but also your direct funerary practice, and I guess just as an observer of death in general, how has COVID changed this landscape? Like, what have you learned being kind of like still dead in the middle of this pandemic?
I'm going to try not to turn this into a 30-minute brain dump. I'll see how concise I can be about this.
I mean, I you take whatever time you want. I'm fascinated.
I think I talked to a friend just last week who has always been, you know, a socialist and very left-leaning. And he was talking about how it was very difficult for a lot of people right now to come to admit that our social services are so poor and our support for workers is so bad, and that we really have a system that's rigged against lower income people.
And rigged and really fragile.
Right. And right. Coming to that knowledge and seeing it all play out in the pandemic can be incredibly painful for people because they're just now coming into the harshness of that knowledge. Whereas he's like, I've been dealing with this for, you know, 20 years and
right.
I've moved past that. So I'm feeling other things. And I think that's actually very similar to my own experience in the sense that I have so deeply interrogated death and dying and what it means to die and all of these different systems that people are only now experiencing. So that's not where my attention is. You know, I haven't been sitting around thinking about my own mortality a lot or what it's going to mean for me to die because I've worked on that. And I'm not dealing with the fear of death so much right now, but I am very fraught over the future of death and the future of the funeral industry. And every time that there's been a major mass death event in the United States history, the Civil War, pandemic of 1918, World War I, World War II, there has been a major shift after it happens. So I don't necessarily see myself as, when COVID first happened, I thought it was important to put out several videos talking about the realities and the funeral industry and, you know, are the dead bodies safe, what we know, etc. But I don't really see myself as a leader mid-pandemic. I'm not like the leader we need right now. You know, I don't see that. But what I do see is that I'm going to have a lot of work to do to continue to advocate and continue to show people a different way and different options as we move out of this. Because people are not happy with how connected they are to mortality right now. They're not happy with what funerals are looking like. They're not happy with how much money they're spending. They're not happy with these things. And so if myself and other people like me and other advocates like me and other funeral homes like mine can be there to adequately show people a different opportunity and a different way, that could potentially be very impactful. And it does sort of keep me up at night thinking about what that would look like and how we move forward, not even right in the next 6 months, but like the next year or two.
Yeah. I mean, anecdotally, have you felt like there are kind of more people reaching out or the types of questions people are asking are different? Like people are hungry for an alternative approach?
I don't know that the questions fundamentally are different. Mm. I do think there's more attention around it. I do think that, and I don't know how much of this has been influenced by the pandemic or just kind of a, you know, rolling rock, gathering more moss as it goes along, but over the last 10 years or so. But I do think that, you know, I find myself being tagged in much more things and brought up in much more situations as just like people kind of in the zeitgeist having these feelings of like, there was a great tweet like a year ago that from some, you know, teenager who was like, I don't want to spend $6,000 on a casket, just yeet me in a hole and move on. And it went viral. And I was like, this is it. This is the zeitgeist changing. This is the zeitgeist funded, because this teenager could never even have heard of me or my work or death positivity or green funerals or any of these things, but still feel connected to the zeitgeist and know that people are changing in that way. And so having things like that and then people being able to be like, hey, you should check out the Order of the Good Death nonprofit, or you should check out like these videos, or you should check out this green funeral resource guide or whatever it is, and having all those resources that exist because more and more people are creating them and becoming involved in this and doing this advocacy. I do hope that there's sort of a tipping point where more people than not know that this is available.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I want to make sure that we have the opportunity. We've sort of tangentially referenced Will My Cat Eat My Eyeballs? And we've talked about it as sort of a book about death, but for kids and with questions that kids ask about death. I mean, I think it's obviously so much more than that. Probably the vast majority of your readers are actually adults who are really fascinated by these topics. The art in this book is incredible. Who did that? How did you go about kind of developing it?
Yeah, it's a Mexican artist named Dani Ruiz, and it's a very modern love story. I found her on Instagram I think she read my first book, and she did just on her Instagram, she did an art piece based on my first book. And when I saw it tagged, I was like, what? This is amazing. Her on Instagram, her handle is at Muertos Ruiz, her last name, R-U-Z.
Love that.
And just the stuff that, the twisted delights that come out of her mind. And what I loved about her art was that I thought it was actually very similar to my writing, or I would like to hope it is, in the sense that it's like has this kind of dark boundary pushing sense to it, but it's so classy and clean and adorable almost.
Adorable. And yeah, it's like whimsical in a way.
It's whimsical, but the actual things going on in the art, she's like a very, you know, very modern Edward Gorey or something in a way.
Absolutely. And, yeah, that's a really great comparison.
You know, I just basically, after we had all our initial conversations, I would just send her the chapters. And I don't think there was a single time where I was like, this design isn't working for me or this doesn't make sense, because they were all so clever and so cool. That, yeah, it was just, and she's just an absolute pleasure to work with.
Oh, I love that. So I have to like point to just a couple of my favorites here. I love that, like, if I ate a bunch of like unpopped popcorn and then got cremated, what would happen? I'm thrilled with these questions like, am I allowed to make jewelry out of my dead loved ones, like out of their bones? You know, there's some really basic questions like, why do we change colors? You know, why does this or that happen to a body? What would my dog look like if I dug my dog up? And of course, the title question, will my cat eat my eyeballs? Maybe you can give us a teaser and and I'll ask the lazy question, which is, will my cat eat my eyeballs?
Spoiler, the answer is not right away.
until they start to smell real good.
No, the fun fact about your beloved pets is that it seems from research that cats... dogs tend to nibble you, tear you, eat at you because they're incredibly anxious, because they can't wake you up. They can't find anyone. What's happening? They're very scared, which is, of course, very sad. But cats seem to eat you because they are hungry.
Right. Like,
they seem to eat you because they very quickly switch you over to a food source, which I think actually kind of tracks very well with what we know about cats and dogs, right?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen, of course, and they're all anecdotal, but the sweet videos of dogs mourning at their, you know, dead owners' gravesites, or you hear stories that dogs literally starve to death next to their dead owners because mm-hmm. they're not going to eat them, even though there's a food source right in front of them.
Right. Yeah, it's very, man's best friend, really, really loyal. Cats, not so much, which I respect. I think if I, you know, I would want my cat to just go for it.
Are you a cat person or a dog person or neither or both?
I would say I'm a puppy person, but an adult cat person.
Huh, interesting.
Yeah.
And I'm asking that as I'm looking my...
Screw kittens and old dogs. Hate them.
I'm looking my not quite elderly dog in the eyes right now. And he's like, why did she say that?
I'm sorry. Crushing. Listen, I'm like a cat. I take what I need and I mean what I say.
Caitlin, I'm so happy. I'm so happy for you that the book is coming out in paperback. I'm so happy for you that even in this really tumultuous time, you've been able to continue to build your practice. You've been able to continue with all of the really important educational efforts that you've been doing now for, as you said, like a decade or more. I think that your message is so fundamentally important. And it's also a part, as you mentioned, of a larger group of people who have a really important message for all of us to help understand our own relationship with death. Before we go, can you kind of maybe point the listeners to places where they can start the process of educating themselves if this is all really new to them?
Yeah, absolutely. Order of the Good Death is our nonprofit and our website. We have a really robust resource section. So you can just get started there clicking around. It will take you out to other websites that specialize in the thing that you're specifically interested in. Or you could just call up Ask a Mortician on YouTube and, you know, browse through the videos and see if something, if you want to just dip your toe in, see if something strikes your fancy.
Yeah, and read her books, especially her new book, Will My Cat Eat My Eyeballs? Look back to the episode that we did previously to maybe fill in some of those gaps. And I think there we talked more about your history going to school to become a mortician and what it means to be a mortician. And of course, yeah, so many resources online. So, Caitlin, thank you so much for doing this. Thanks for staying up late with me.
It's like a late night chat with a girlfriend. A deaf girlfriend.
Well,
congratulations on your PhD journey. I'm so excited for you.
Thanks. And maybe offline in the future, we can talk about some cool research that we could do together or a way to kind of combine forces, the pre and post-death approach.
Oh, I'm in. Let's do it.
I love it. All right, everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.